This is Audible.
Oshet Audio presents Squirrel Seeks Chipmunk, written by David Sedaris. Read by David Sedaris, Elaine Stritch, Dylan Baker, and Sean Phillips.
The Cat and the Baboon. The cat had a party to attend and went to the baboon to get herself groomed. "What kind of party?" the baboon asked. And she massaged the cat's neck in order to relax her, the way she did with all her customers. "Hope it's not that harvest dance down on the riverbank. My sister went last year and said she'd never seen such rowdiness. Said a fight broke out between two possums, and one gal, the wife of one of the other, got pushed onto a stump and knocked out 4 teeth. And they were pretty ones, too. None of this yellowness you find on most things that eat trash." The cat shuddered. "No," she said. "This is just a little get-together, a few friends, that type of thing." "Will there be food?" the baboon asked. "Something," the cat sighed. "I just don't know what." "Course it's hard," the baboon said. "Everybody eating different things. You got one who likes leaves, and another who can't stand the sight of them. Folks have gotten so picky nowadays, I just lay out some peanuts and figure they either eat them or they don't." "Now, I wouldn't like a peanut," the cat said. "Not at all." "Well, I guess you just have drinks then. The trick is knowing when to stop." "That's never been a problem for me," the cat boasted. "I drink until I'm full, and then I push myself away from the table. Always have." "Well, you've got sense then. Not like some of them around here." The baboon picked a flea from the cat's head and stuck it gingerly between her teeth. "Take this wedding I went to last Saturday, I think it was. Couple of marsh rabbits got married. You probably heard about it?" The cat nodded. "Now, I like a church service, but this one was one of those write-your-own-vows sort of things. Neither of them had ever picked up a pen in their life, and all of a sudden they're poets, right? Like that's all it takes? Being in love." "My husband and I wrote our own vows," the cat said defensively. "Oh, sure you did," the baboon said, "but you probably had something to say. Not like these marsh rabbits carrying on that their love was like a tender sapling or some damn thing. And all the while they had this squirrel off to the side, plucking at a harp, I think it was." "I had a harp player at my wedding," the cat said, "and it was lovely." "I bet it was, but you probably hired a professional, someone who could really play. This squirrel, I don't think she'd taken a lesson in her life. Just clawed at those strings almost like she was mad at him." "Well, I'm sure she tried her best," the cat said. The baboon nodded and smiled, the way one must in the service industry. She'd planned to tell a story about a drunken marsh rabbit, the brother of the groom at last week's wedding, but there was no point in it now, not with this client anyway. Whatever she said, the cat disagreed with, and unless she found a patch of common ground, she was sure to lose her tip. "You know," she said, cleaning a scab off the cat's neck, "I hate dogs. Simply cannot stand them." "What makes you bring that up?" the cat asked. "Just thinking," the baboon said. "Some kind of spaniel mix walked in yesterday asking for a shampoo, and I sent him packing. Said, 'I don't care how much money you have, I'm not making conversation with anyone who licks his own ass.' And the moment she said it, she realized her mistake." "Now what's wrong with that?" the cat protested. "It's good to have a clean anus. Why, I lick mine at least 5 times a day. And I admire you for it, the baboon said. But you're not a dog. Meaning? On a cat, it's classy, the baboon said. There's a grace to it. But a dog, you know the way they hunker over, legs going every which way? Well, yes, the cat said. I suppose you have a point. Then they slobber and drool all over everything, and what they don't get wet, they chew to pieces. That they do, the cat chuckled. And the baboon relaxed and searched her memory for a slanderous dog story. The collie, the German shepherd, the spaniel mix she claimed to have turned away, they were all good friends of hers and faithful clients. But what would it hurt to pretend otherwise and cross that fine line between licking ass and simply kissing it?
The Migrating Warblers. The yellow warbler would often claim that she was fine until she hit Brownsville. Then, wham, she'd tell her friends. I don't know if it's the air or what, but whenever we pass it on our migration, I have to stop and puke my guts out. That she does, her husband would chuckle. An hour or two's rest is all I need, but isn't it strange? Not Olmedo or Bayview or Indian Lake, but Brownsville, Brownsville every time. The birds she was talking to would try to sound sympathetic or, at the very least, interested. Hmm, they'd say, or Brownsville, I think I have a cousin there. From the southern tip of Texas, the couple would fly over Mexico and then into Central America. My family's been wintering in Guatemala for as long as I can remember, the warbler would explain. Every year, like clockwork, here we come by the tens of thousands. But do you think any of those Spanish-speaking birds have bothered learning English? Not on your life. It's really horrible, her husband would say. Well, funny, too, his wife would insist. Horrible and funny. Like one time, I asked this little Guatemalan bird, I said, ¿Dónde estás las grandes moscas de cabeza? Here her listeners would cock their heads, confused and more than a little impressed. Wait a second, you speak that stuff? Oh, I've picked some up, the warbler would say in that offhand way of hers. I mean, really, what choice do I have? I guess I'm a pretty quick study. At least I've been told I am. She's terrific with languages, her husband would boast. And his wife would raise a wing in protest. Well, not always. In this particular case, for instance, I thought I'd asked where all the big horseflies were. A reasonable question, only instead of caballo, which is horse, I said, cabeza. So what I really asked was, where are all the big head flies? Thinking that this was the end of the story, her listeners would quake with polite laughter. Head flies, oh, that's rich. But no, wait, the warbler would say. So the Guatemalan bird makes a motion for me to follow him through the thicket. I do, and there in this field are like 300 heads rotting in the afternoon sun. Each one with about 50 flies on it, and I mean huge, the size of acorns, every one of them. Oh, my God, the listeners would say. Rotting heads with flies on them? Oh, they weren't bird heads, the warbler would reassure them. These belong to humans, or used to, anyway. Flesh bubbling off, hair all tangled with bits of goo in it. I don't know what they'd done with the bodies, burned them, maybe. Then they used the heads to make a wall. Actually, it was more like a counter, her husband would say. It was a wall, if ever there was one, but what could you do? Ask everyone to stop up their ears, while you and your ridiculous mate, someone who would never even seen a counter except in pictures, scream at each other for half an hour? No, it was best just to breeze over it. So we see this wall, this counter be it, made of human heads, and I mean to say, this place stinks like the devil, but what I actually say is, and here, snorting with laughter, she would pass the baton to her husband. What she actually says to this small Guatemalan bird is, "The devil smells me in my place. Can you believe it? My mate, ladies and gentlemen, or as we like to call her south of the border, Satan's sexy stinkpot." The listeners would crack up, and the warblers, husband and wife, would enjoy the sensation of having an audience right where they wanted them. This was the reward for spending 3 months a year in an inferior country. And when the light fell a certain way, when the laughter surged and melded into a harmonious song, it almost made up for all the hardships, the stomach flus, for instance, or the times when, rather than uniting you and your mate, the strangeness of another culture only made you feel more separate, more despicable and alone. Back in their element, the two warblers were a well-oiled machine. "You want funny? Try getting work done down there," the husband would say, opening the door to their hilarious tales of lazy natives, of how bumbling they were, how backward and superstitious. This begged the question, why go in the first place? Why not winter in Florida like everyone else? The warblers would then explain that despite the incompetence, despite the language barriers and the severed heads, Central America was, in its own way, beautiful. And cheap, they would add. Cheap, cheap, cheap.
The Squirrel and the Chipmunk. The squirrel and the chipmunk had been dating for 2 weeks when they ran out of things to talk about. Acorns, parasites, the inevitable approach of autumn, these subjects had been covered within their first hour, and so breathlessly their faces had flushed. Twice they had held long conversations about dogs, each declaring an across-the-board hatred of them, and speculating on what life might be like were someone to put a bowl of food in front of them 2 times a day. "They're spoiled rotten, is what it comes down to," the chipmunk had said. And the squirrel had placed his paw over hers, saying, "That's it exactly. Finally, someone who really gets it." Friends had warned them that their romance could not possibly work out, and such moments convinced them that the skeptics were not just wrong, but jealous. "They'll never have what we do," the squirrel would say, and then the two of them would sit quietly, hoping for a flash flood, or a rifle report, something, anything, that might generate a conversation. They were out one night at a little bar run by a couple of owls when, following a long silence, the squirrel slapped his palm against the tabletop. "You know what I like," he said. "I like jazz." "I didn't know that," the chipmunk said. "My goodness, jazz." She had no idea what jazz was, but worried that asking would make her sound stupid. "What kind, exactly?" she asked, hoping his answer might narrow things down a bit. "Well, all kinds, really," he told her, "especially the earlier stuff." "Me too," she said. And when he asked her why, she told him that the later stuff was just too late for her tastes. "Almost like it was overripe or something, you know what I mean?" Then, for the third time since she had known him, the squirrel reached across the table and took her paw. On returning home that evening, the chipmunk woke her older sister, with whom she shared a room. "Listen," she whispered, "I need you to explain something." "What's jazz?" "Why are you asking me?" the sister said. "So you don't know either?" the chipmunk asked. "I didn't say I didn't know," the sister said. "I asked you why you're asking. Does this have anything to do with that squirrel?" "Maybe," the chipmunk said. "Well, I'm telling," the sister announced. "First thing tomorrow morning, because this has gone on long enough." She punched at her pillow of moss, then repositioned it beneath her head. "I warned you weeks ago that this wouldn't work out. And now you've got the whole house in an uproar, waltzing home in the middle of the night, waking me up with your dirty little secrets. Jazz, indeed. Just you wait until Mother hears about this. The chipmunk lay awake that night, imagining the unpleasantness that was bound to take place the following morning. What if jazz was squirrel slang for something terrible, like anal intercourse? Oh, I like it too, she'd said, and so eagerly. Then again, it could just be mildly terrible, something along the lines of communism or fortune-telling, subjects that were talked about but hardly ever practiced. Just as she thought she had calmed herself down, a new possibility would enter her mind, each one more horrible than the last. Jazz was the maggot-infested flesh of a dead body, the crust on an infected eye, another word for ritual suicide, and she had claimed to like it. Years later, when she could put it all in perspective, she'd realize that she never really trusted the squirrel. How else to explain all those terrible possibilities? Had he been another chipmunk, even a tough one, she'd have assumed that jazz was something familiar, a kind of root, say, or maybe a hairstyle. Of course, her sister hadn't helped any. None of her family had. "It's not that I have anything against squirrels per se," her mother had said. "It's just that this one, well, I don't like him." When pressed for details, she'd mentioned his fingernails, which were a little too long for her taste. "A sure sign of vanity," she warned. "And now there's this jazz business." That was what did it. Following the sleepless night, the chipmunk's mother had forced her to break it off. "Well," the squirrel had sighed, "I guess that's that." "I guess it is," the chipmunk said. He headed downriver a few days later, and she never saw him or heard from him again. "It's not a great loss," her sister said. "No girl should be subjected to language like that, especially from the likes of him." "Amen," her mother added. Eventually, the chipmunk met someone else. And after she had safely married, her mother speculated that perhaps jazz was a branch of medicine. Something like chiropractic therapy that wasn't quite legitimate. Her sister said no, it was more likely a jig, and then she pushed herself back from the table and kicked her chubby legs into the air. "Oh, you," her mother said, "that's a can-can." And then she joined in and gave a few kicks of her own. This stuck in the chipmunk's mind, as she never knew her mother could identify a dance step or anything associated with fun. It was the way her own children would eventually think of her. Dull, strict, chained to the past. She had boys, all of them healthy, and only one prone to trouble. He had a habit of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, but his heart was good, and the chipmunk knew he would eventually straighten himself out. Her husband thought so too, and died knowing that he had been correct. A month or two after he'd passed on, she asked this son what jazz was. And when he told her it was a kind of music, she knew instinctively that he was telling the truth. "Is it bad music?" she asked. "Well, if it's played badly," he said. "Otherwise, it's really quite pleasant." "Did squirrels invent it?" "God, no," he said. "Whoever gave you that idea?" The chipmunk stroked her brown and white muzzle. "Nobody," she said. "I was just guessing." When her muzzle grew more white than brown, the chipmunk forgot that she and the squirrel had had nothing to talk about. She forgot the definition of jazz as well, and came to think of it as every beautiful thing she had ever failed to appreciate. The taste of warm rain. The smell of a baby. The din of a swollen river rushing past her tree and onward to infinity.
The Toad, the Turtle, and the Duck. The complaint line started at the edge of the swamp and stretched westward, ending where the turtle finally arrived, at the base of a charred pine stump. He fell into place behind a glassy-eyed toad and had just commenced a jaw-aching yawn when a duck showed up and took the position behind him, muttering, "What a bunch of idiots." The turtle, his mouth still open, nodded in agreement. "This is my second time in this line, can you believe it?" groused the duck. "First they told me I wouldn't need any ID. Then, after I waited almost 3 hours, this ball-busting river rat goes, 'I'm sorry, sir, but if you don't have some form of identification, there's nothing I can do.' I was like, 'Why the hell didn't you tell me that earlier?' And she was all, 'If you can't be civil, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave.'" The turtle groaned in sympathy, as something similar had once happened to him. "It's the oldest trick in the book," he said. "They screw up, but somehow you're the problem." I said to her, "You want civil? Try working for a company that doesn't give everyone the goddamn runaround," the duck continued. "You can't very well complain about our complaining when you're the one who's given us something to complain about."
"Well put," said the turtle, who was, he'd later admit, genuinely impressed. "You don't expect such clarity from a duck or any bird, really, but this one totally nailed it," he'd tell his wife when he got home that evening.
It was here that the toad entered the conversation.
"You want pissed off? I got to the front of the line, I showed my ID, and I was then told that I needed two forms of it. Can you beat that? I said, 'I didn't see that ugly-ass bobcat give you two forms.' And the one behind the counter, a black snake, she was, said that this was a special rule just for reptiles. I said, 'No problem, I'm an amphibian.' And to this, she goes, 'I kid you not, same difference.' I said, 'It's not the same fucking difference. First off, I only mate in the water. Number two, the skin I was born with, I still got it. So don't feed me any of that same difference bullshit. You should know that better than anyone.' Then she gives me the same line of crap the river rat gave this duck, all, 'I'm sorry, sir, but if you're gonna use that type of language—'"
The turtle rolled his eyes.
"Typical."
"I should have punched her," the toad said. "Right in the face. Pow."
"I'm with you, brother," said the duck. "Or no," continued the toad. "I should have gouged out her eyes, blinded her, so she had to spend the rest of her life in darkness."
The turtle had a blind cousin, a cousin he hated, and this made him laugh all the harder.
"Then I should have yanked out her tongue," the toad said. "See how she liked that?"
"Not so easy giving us shit when she can't talk," said the duck.
"After all that, I should have set her on fire," added the toad. "No, I should have poured acid on her and then set her on fire, the stupid bitch."
The turtle started saying something, but the toad, excited by a new possibility, interrupted him.
"Or wait, no. After cutting off her tongue, I should have smeared an apple with shit, opened up her big fat mouth, and forced it down her throat. Then I should have poured acid on her. Then I should have set her on fire."
The three of them laughed.
"Better yet, you should have used a cantaloupe," said the turtle.
"Cover that with shit and stuff it down her throat. Ha!"
Or no, said the duck. Instead of a cantaloupe, you should have used a watermelon. Then you...
And here the merry atmosphere soured. A watermelon for the black snake, said the toad.
Now you're just being a racist.
No, the duck said. I only meant...
I know what you meant, the toad said, and I think it stinks.
Hear, hear, agreed the turtle.
Yeah? Well, to hell with the both of you, said the duck,
and he waddled off, muttering under his breath.
God, I hate guys like him, the toad said. A watermelon. He wouldn't have said that if she'd been a king snake, and he damn sure wouldn't have said it if she were a python.
The pair looked at the retreating duck and shook their heads in disgust. A moment of silence, and then the toad continued.
I should have smeared a honeydew with shit, or no, a honeydew and a cantaloupe. I should have smeared both melons with shit and forced them down her throat. Then I should have poured acid on her, and then I should have set her on fire.
Well, said the turtle, there's always the next time.
The Motherless Bear. In the 3 hours before her death, the bear's mother unearthed some acorns, buried months earlier by a squirrel. They were damp and worm-eaten, as unappetizing as turds, and sighing at her rotten luck, she kicked them back into their hole. At around 10, she stopped to pull a burr from her left haunch, and then... her daughter would report, then she just died. The first 10 times she said these words, the bear could not believe them. Her mother gone, how could it be? After a day, though, the shock wore off, and she tried to recapture it with an artfully placed pause and an array of amateur theatrical gestures. The faraway look was effective, and eventually she came to master it. And then, she would say, her eyes fixed on the distant horizon, then she just died. 7 times she cried, but as the weeks passed, this became more difficult, and so she took to covering her face with her paws and doing a jerky thing with her shoulders. There, there, friends would say. And she would imagine them returning to their families. I saw that poor motherless bear today, and if she doesn't just break your heart, well, I don't know what will. Her neighbors brought food, more than enough to get her through the winter, so she stayed awake that year and got very fat. In the spring, the others awoke from their hibernations and found her finishing the first of the choke cherries. Eating helps ease the pain, she explained, the bright juice dripping from her chin. And when they turned away, she followed behind them. Did I mention to you that my mother died? We just spent a beautiful morning together, and the next thing I knew, that's no excuse for eating all our choke cherries, they said, furious. A few bears listened without interruption, but she could see in their eyes that their pity had turned to something else, boredom at best, and at worst a kind of embarrassment, not for themselves, but for her. The friend, who had previously been the most sympathetic, who herself had cried upon first hearing the story, now offered a solution. "Throw yourself into a project," she said. "That's what I did after my grandfather's heart attack, and it worked wonders." "A project?" the bear said. "You know," said her friend, "dig yourself a new den or something." "But I like my den the way it is." "Then help dig one for somebody else. My ex-husband's aunt lost one of her paws in a trap and spent last winter in a ditch. Help her, why don't you?" "I hurt my paw once," the bear said. "Broke a nail clean off, and when it finally grew back, it looked like a Brazil nut." She was trying to work the subject back to herself, hoping her friend might forget her suggestion, but it didn't work. "I'll tell the old gal you'll be by later this afternoon," she said. "It'll make her happy and help you to work off some of that weight you've gained." The friend ambled off, and the bear glared at her disappearing backside. "Help you work off some of that weight you gained," she mimicked. Then she overturned a log and ate some ants, low-calorie ones, with stripes on their butts. After that, she lay in the sun and was sound asleep when her friend returned and shook her awake, saying, "What's wrong with you?" "Huh? It's almost dark, and my ex-husband's aunt has been waiting all day." "Right," said the bear, and she headed up the hill, deciding after a few dozen yards that this was not going to happen. Forget following advice she had never asked for in the first place. Rather than digging a den for a stranger, someone old who was just going to die anyway, she'd leave home and settle on the other side of the mountain. There she could meet some new bears, strangers who would listen to her story and allow her once again to feel tragic. The following morning she set out, taking care to avoid the old amputee who still sat waiting beside her wretched ditch. Beyond a burned-out grove of birch trees, there was a stream, and following it she came upon a cub who sat waist-deep in the rushing water, swatting at fish with his untrained paws. "I used to do the same thing when I was your age," called the bear, and the cub looked up and let out a cry of surprise. "I must have sat in the water all morning until my mother came over and showed me how to catch fish properly." She waited a beat and then continued, "Of course, that could never happen now. And you know why?" The cub said nothing. "It couldn't happen now because my mother is dead," the bear announced. "Happened suddenly when I least expected it. One moment she was there, and the next she just wasn't." The cub began to whimper. "You wake up an orphan, your mom's body slowly rotting beside you. And what can you do but soldier on? All alone, with no one to love or protect you." As the cub began to wail, his mother charged out of the thicket. "What, are you sick?" she shouted. "Get your kicks scaring innocent children, is that it? Go on now, get the hell out of here." The bear ran to the opposite shore and into the forest, tripping on logs as she turned to look behind her. What with her weight, she was soon out of breath, so she slowed to a trot after the first 100 yards. Her pace gradually degenerating as the morning turned to afternoon and then early evening. Just before dusk, she smelled chimney smoke and ambled to the outskirts of a village. Peering through a gap in a thick hedge, she saw a crowd of humans standing with their backs to her. They seemed to be regarding something that stood in a clearing, and when one of them shifted position, she saw that it was a bear. A male, though it took a moment to realize it, as he was wearing a skirt and a tall, cone-shaped hat topped with a satin scarf. The male bear's mouth was muzzled with leather straps and connected to a leash, which was alternately held and yanked by a man in a dirty cape. A boy who was also dressed in a cape carried a drum on a rope around his neck, and as he began to play, the male stood on his hind legs and swayed back and forth to the music. "Faster," called a soldier at the front of the crowd, and the boy quickened his beat. The male bear struggled to keep up, and when he tripped over the hem of his skirt, the man pulled out a stick and beat him across the face until his nose bled. This made the people laugh, and a few of them threw coins, which the drummer collected before moving on to his next song. When night fell and the audience went home to their suppers, the man removed the muzzle from the male's snout. Then he put a collar around his neck and attached it by a chain to an iron stake driven deep into the ground. He and the boy retired to a tent, and when she was sure they had fallen asleep, the bear crept out from behind the hedge and approached the chained dancer. "I don't normally talk to strangers," she said. "But I saw you here, and I figured, well, I guess there's a first time for everything." The male was lying in an awkward position. His skirt was gathered around his waist, and she saw that great patches of his legs were without hair, and that the skin in these areas was covered with open sores. "I used to talk a lot to my mother," she told him. "She and I were all each other had. And then one morning, out of nowhere, she just died. Gone. Before I could say goodbye or anything. Maybe it was the moonlight, maybe the excitement of meeting an entertainer, but for whatever reason, she actually managed a tear. Her first in almost 6 months. It was running slowly down her cheek when the chained male raised his head and spoke. "Can you understand me?" he asked. The bear nodded, though in fact it was quite difficult. "That's good," he said. "Most animals can't make out a word I'm saying, and you know why?" She shook her head. "It's because I have no teeth," he said. "Not a one of them." The man in the tent took a rock and hammered them on my head. "But the muzzle," the bear said. "That just to make me look dangerous." "Oh," the bear said. "I get it." "No," he told her, "I don't think you do. See, I have maggots living in my knees. I'm alive. But flies are raising families in my flesh, okay?" The bear shivered at the thought of it. "It's been years since I've eaten solid food. My digestive system is shot. My right foot is broken in 3 places. And you're coming to me all teary-eyed because your stepmother died?" "She wasn't a step," the bear said. "Oh, she was too. I can see it in your eyes. Well, she was just like a real mother," the bear said. "Yeah, and piss is just like honey if you're hungry enough." "Maybe males in this part of the country say every ugly thing that enters their heads," the bear said. "But where I'm from..." That was as far as she got before the man and the boy came up from behind and hit her over the head with a padded club. When she came to, it was morning, and the male lay on the ground before her, his throat slit into a meaty smile. "He wasn't no good to us anyhow," the man said to his assistant. "The knees go, and that's that." Now the bear travels from village to village. Her jaws are sunken, her gums swollen with the abscesses left by broken teeth. And between the disfigurement and the muzzle, it's nearly impossible to catch what she's saying. Always, though, while tripping and stumbling to the music, she looks out into her audience and tells the story about her mother. Most people laugh and yell for her to lift her skirts. But every so often she'll spot someone weeping and swear they can understand her every word.
The Mouse and the Snake. Plenty of animals had pets, but few were more devoted than the mouse, who owned a baby corn snake. A rescue snake, she'd be quick to inform you. This made it sound like he'd been snatched from the jaws of a raccoon, but what she'd really rescued him from was a life without her love. And what sort of a life would that have been? I saw him hatching from his little egg and knew right then that I had to save him, she was fond of saying. I mean, look at that face. How could I have said no? The snake would flick his split ribbon of tongue, and his mistress would dandle the scales beneath his chin. He sang, "Hello, new friend. Nice to meet you." But the friends weren't so sure. When the serpent coiled, they jumped and fretted, reactions that left the mouse feeling almost unbelievably special. Exotic, really, which was different from eccentric. To qualify for the latter, all you needed was a turban, an affinity for ridiculously large beads or the color purple. To be exotic, on the other hand, one had to think not just outside the box, but outside the world of boxes. "You're not afraid of my snake," the mouse would insist. "You're afraid of the idea of him. Why, this little fellow wouldn't strike if his life depended on it. Haven't I explained that?" She'd then describe how he slept at the foot of her bed and woke her each morning with a kiss. He says, "Get up, Mommy. It's time to start the day." The snake was the smartest, the handsomest, the most thoughtful creature that had ever lived. The way he lay in the sun or stared dumbly into space for hours on end, it was uncanny. "He thinks he's one of us," the mouse told her friends, who responded with increasingly forced smiles. In time, she stopped using the word pet as it seemed demeaning. The term to own was banished as well, as it made it sound as though she were keeping him against his will, like a firefly trapped in a jar. "He's a reptile companion," she took to saying, and thus, in time, he became her only companion. This suited the mouse just fine. "I never had anything in common with them anyway," she said. "Not even the ones my own age." The snake blinked as if to say, "All we need is each other," and the mouse reached out to hug his slender neck. It was almost spooky how like-minded they were. On the weather, on the all-important hoard or binge question, the two were most definitely on the same page. Both liked weekends. Both hated owls. Their opinions differed only when it came to food. "Won't you at least try a bit of grain?" the mouse had asked when the snake was very young. He wouldn't, though, preferring instead a live baby toad. How he could eat these things was beyond her. She'd taken a bite once just to see what it was like, and the ghost of it, viscous and fishy, had lingered in her mouth for days. You couldn't expect a youngster, especially such a vulnerable one, to hunt his own food, and so the mouse did it for him. Aside from the baby toads, she'd fetched him a robin's egg and a very young mole, which, like everything else, he ate whole. "My goodness," she said. "Slow down. Taste." In those first few months, their lunch was followed by a speech therapy session. "Can you say, 'Hello, mouse friend?' Can you say, 'I love you'?" Eventually, she saw the chauvinism of her attempt. Why should he learn to speak like a rodent? Why not the other way around? Hence, she made it her business to try and master Snake. After weeks of getting nowhere, she split her tongue with a razor. This didn't make it any easier to communicate, but it did give them something else in common. The two were in front of the fireplace one afternoon, softly hissing at each other, when someone knocked on the door. It was a toad. And after a great sigh at the inconvenience, the mouse stepped onto the front stoop to greet her. Even without the mimeographed flyers under her arm, anyone could have guessed why she was here. It was that long-suffering mother look so common to amphibians who had children by the thousands and then fell apart when a handful were sacrificed to a higher cause. "I'm sorry to barge in on you this way," the toad said, "but a few of my babies has taken off, and I'm just about at my wit's end." She blew her nose into her open palm, then wiped the snotty hand against her thigh. There's boys as well as girls, 9 in all, and wasn't one of 'em old enough to fend for themselves. It was this last part that tested the mouse's patience, fend for themselves, as if a toad needed any particular training. They hatched, they opened their eyes, and then they hopped around, each one as graceless and unappealing as a stone. "Well," the mouse said, "if you were that concerned for the safety of your children, you probably should have kept an eye on them." "But I did," wept the toad. "They're just outside, playing in the yard like youngsters do." "Playing, indeed," thought the mouse. And she recalled the patch of sandy soil, bare but for a single withered dandelion. The area bordered a thicket of tall ferns, and that was where she had hidden herself and lured the listless, gullible children with the promise of cluster flies. If they hadn't been starving and possibly brain damaged due to their upbringing, they wouldn't have so blindly followed her, so really, wasn't this the toad's fault? Where was her pity when flies came to the door, asking about their missing babies? Was an insect's mother love any less worthy than an amphibian's? And wasn't the snake a baby as well, as cute and innocent and deserving of protection as any other living creature? It pained the mouse to realize that, while he'd always be adorable, her companion was not the little one he had been. In the months since she'd rescued him, he'd grown almost 5 inches, and there seemed to be no stopping him. Underage toads would not suffice for much longer, and so the mouse accepted a leaflet and studied it for a moment. "I'll tell you what," she said. "How's about I keep my eyes open and you check back with me in, oh, say about 2 weeks or so? How does that sound?" A few days later, there came another knock, this time from a mole. "I'm wondering," she asked, "if you've by any chance seen my daughter." "Well, I don't know," the mouse said. "What did she look like?" The mole shrugged. "Don't know exactly. I guess most likely she looked like me, but smaller." "It's a shame when things you love go missing," the mouse said. "Take these grubs, for instance. I had a whole colony living in my backyard. Darlings, every one, and just so smart you couldn't keep up with them. One moment they were there, and the next thing I knew, they'd taken off. No note or anything." Her visitor looked at the ground for a moment, and the mouse thought, exactly. If awards were given to the world's biggest hypocrites, you'd be hard-pressed to choose between the moles and the toads. "To answer your question, I did meet a little mole," the mouse said. "A girl it was, said she'd run away from home and asked if she could come live with me for a while. I told her, well, maybe you should think it over and not be so rash. I said, why don't you see how you feel in a month and then come back?"
"A month?"
wailed the mole. "That's what I told her, so why don't you do the same? If your daughter is here, I'll keep her for you, and if not, at least you tried." Off went the mole, buoyed with hope, and the mouse stepped back into her house. "Idiot," she whispered. The snake lifted its flat head off the carpet, and she explained that from now on, his meals would deliver themselves. "That's all the more time we can spend together," she said. "Would you like that, baby? I know you would." Out slid the snake's forked tongue, and she thought again that she had never seen such a beautiful creature. Smart, too. Beautiful and smart, and above all, loyal. A month later, the mole was back. She stood at the door, knocking politely, and just as she began pounding, the toad walked by. "If you're looking for that mouse, I think you can probably forget it," she called. The mole whirled around and squinted. "I came by 2 weeks ago and did just what you're doing. Knocked on that door till I just about busted it, but didn't nobody answer. Then I talked to some squirrels yonder, and they said there hadn't been smoke out the chimney since the beginning of the month. Strange, they said, because that mouse always had a fire going, even in summer. Their guess and mine, too, is that she took off. Maybe found a mate or something. You know how mice are. Anything for a little affection." The mole, distressed, spilled out the story of her missing child. The toad did the same. But had they not wept and commiserated, had they instead put their ears to the door, they might have heard the snake, his belly full of unconditional love, banging to be let out. Thank you.
The Parenting Storks. The precocious stork was only 2 weeks old when he asked where babies come from. Goodness, said his mother. I mean, golly, that's quite some question. She considered herself to be as modern as anyone, but didn't you have to draw the line somewhere? Let me get back to you on that, she said, and she shoved a herring down his throat with a bit more force than usual. Later that day, the mother stork repeated the conversation to her sister, who also had a recently born chick. She meant it as a don't kids say the darndest things type of story and was unprepared for the reaction she got. Your only son came to you for answers, and you didn't give them to him? Well, of course I didn't, the stork said. Why, he's just a baby himself. How can he be expected to understand something so complicated? So, children should be put off, or even worse, lied to. Until they're old enough, sure. So, we lie, and we lie, and then one day they're just supposed to believe us. Well, that's how it was with our family, and I never felt particularly traumatized, the stork said. Besides, they're not lies so much as stories. There's a difference. Oh, is there, spat her sister, surprised at how angry this was making her. Give me an example. The stork squinted over the surrounding rooftops until something came to her. All right, I remember seeing my first full moon and being told by Grandad that it was a distant natural satellite formed billions of years ago. And I believed it for the longest time until I learned the truth. The truth, her sister said. God made it, announced the stork. Her sister felt suddenly ill. Who? God, the stork repeated. He made the world and the heavens, all of it, out of dust and willpower, and in less than a week. I overheard a cardinal talking about him on top of the cathedral in the square, and it was really quite instructive. So, is that who brings the babies? God? Lord, no, the stork said. Babies are brought by mice. It took a moment before her sister could speak. Oh, sweetie, she said. Our babies are huge. So how on earth... These are special mice, the stork explained, capable of lifting things much heavier than themselves. They hide until you lay your eggs, see, and then... When your back is turned, they slip the chicks inside. But we build our nests on chimney tops, the sister said. How could a little mouse, a mouse carrying a live, vivacious newborn, climb that high? And how does he hold the chick while he does it? Ever hear of magic pockets? The stork asked. Magic mice pockets, sure, her sister said, and she wondered how anyone so gullible could manage to feed herself, much less build a nest and raise a child. And where exactly did you get this information? Oh, said the stork, just this guy I've been having sex with. Now it was her sister's turn to stare over the rooftops. I know, she said. Why not tell your son that's where babies come from? Sex! It's crazy, I know, but maybe it will tide him over until he's old enough to grasp the whole magic mouse concept. You think so? I do, her sister said. The stork flew off, and her sister, shaken, watched her go. They'd both had the same parents, and had both left the nest at roughly the same time. They lived in the same town and drank the same water, so how was it that she herself had turned out to be so smart, while her poor sister was so confused? With the conversation still fresh in her mind, she returned to her own child, a female born 10 days earlier. The chick opened her beak for food, and the stork sighed. I know you're hungry, but Mother's had an exhausting afternoon and needs to recharge her batteries before she puts on her slave hat. She picked a few feathers out of the nest and flicked them over the edge. Do you want to know why Mummy's exhausted? The child opened her beak even wider, and the stork let out a moan. Oh, it really wouldn't hurt you to take an interest in others, she said. I tell you, I'm depressed. I tell you, I feel cornered and lonely, and your response is, fine, now feed me, which is actually very insensitive of you. All mothers feel unconditional love for their children, but there's a timer on it, all right. It doesn't last forever, especially when you're selfish. The child closed her beak. Mummy's depressed because your cousin wanted to know where babies come from. Now, this is all perfectly natural for someone your age, nothing at all to be ashamed of. Sex is a beautiful and important part of life. I explained that to you last week when we discussed your father's infidelity. Remember, we talked about Daddy's cheating. I told you that there were good lovers and bad ones, and that your father is pathologically inattentive to the needs of his partners. I said that you were not conceived of mutual orgasm, and that it probably affected your ability to empathize. Remember? A crow flew by, and keeping her head perfectly still, the child followed it with her eyes. It's caring too deeply that has got me depressed, not about you so much as your aunt, who told me with great authority that babies are brought by mice. The child's eyes widened. That was my reaction as well, said the stork. She looked at her daughter and for the first time in days felt a splinter of hope. Then, feeling hungry, she flew off in search of food. The chick watched her go and wished once again that she had a brother or sister, someone, anyone, besides her mother, who never for one moment stopped talking about herself. She'd thought since birth that she was fated to be an only child. But maybe the mice could change that. The question was, how did they work? Did they visit every nest in turn? Was it possible that they took requests and would come when charmed or summoned? The chick leaned over the edge of the nest, hoping to see one of these mice and call out to it. Then she leaned out a little farther.